First Amendment to our Constitution, the amendment which precludes religious establishment in these United States, has been in effect for 179 years. There is no one of us who would say that a complete separation of church or the churches, the state, has been affected. Christmas and Easter are national holidays, and they play a very significant role even in the curriculum of our public schools. Chaplains are not drafted. Church property is exempt from taxation. In most of the states, cross-religious adoption is prohibited. And the majority of the states still very narrowly limit the cases in which abortion will be permitted according to the very narrow limitations of canon church law. Most of the states, and increasingly so, various subterfuges have been devised in order to provide public aid to the private and parochial schools. And it is obvious that we are moving more and more openly in that direction. Now, I cite these facts not to launch into a civil libertarian address, but simply to suggest that it is unbecoming to us to do what I've heard a number do during the last several weeks, to titch-titch and cluck-cluck about the so-called coerciveness of the Orthodox or the synagogue, the church, in Israel. In point of fact, there is no religious coercion as such in Israel. Anyone can worship as he sees fit. Anyone can preach from the pulpit of his congregation what he or she sees fit. One does not need to be a Jew to immigrate to Israel or to be naturalized in Israel. There are no religious tests for office or office holding. Those who are non-Jews have roles in the government and are members of the Knesset as well as of many of the town councils and other offices. Now, there are areas in which the law finds it difficult to adjust and to adjudicate between the demands of some of the religious communities and between the wishes of the majority or the will of the state. But I've tried to suggest that some of these tensions exist in America also. And I would suggest to you that Israel is only 22 years of age, a beleaguered nation whose security is certainly not yet established, a country which, above all else, must maintain cohesion and unity within, could not afford a Kulturkampf, a religious battle, a battle of conflicting political ideologies, certainly at this moment in time. And so it's relatively impressive, if you take an historical view, to see how much religious freedom actually exists in the state. Compare it with America at age 22. There was in America, as there is today in Israel, no civil marriage. The Sunday Blue Laws were enforced in all of the communities of the United States quite rigidly, with a vigor that the Sabbath laws are not enforced in Israel. There was unabashed teaching, denominational teaching in the schools. In Israel, there is a public school system, quite apart from the parochial system. And the majority of the state legislatures, when the United States was only 22 years of age, forced their members to take an oath of office as Christian gentlemen. There is no such term, such oath, such restriction within Israel today. I'd further like to suggest to you that in a democracy where there are various widely held views as to the purpose of the state and to the values which the society ought to be organized about, there must be compromise. One must allow time and experience and community to develop slowly. One cannot force a nation into democracy by fiat to accept a particular definition of the national will. I say this because Israel is not simply a state. No state is simply a state. Each state has a personality, a history. The people who form it have traditions. Those who came to these United States, some came to escape religious persecution and to find freedom here. Some came to escape religious persecution and to reestablish here a perfect religious community, which in fact, once it was established, persecuted those who would not adopt this a particular denominational line. And some came simply to find adventure or opportunity. There were all kinds of reasons to come here, and it has taken a long, long time for the polity, the common weal, to develop and to adjust and to adjudicate these different points of view. And each has, in its own peculiar and particular way, made a contribution to the development of the nation. And so it is in Israel. Israel was to be the Jewish state. But what does that mean? To some, it meant that Israel was to be the state in which the government would sponsor, if you will, the traditional rabbinic law, that which made a Jewish community in Europe Jewish. To some, it meant that Israel was to be a Jewish state, simply that it was to see the fulfillment of the noblest ethics of the prophetic tradition. And there was no talk about rabbinic law, Torah law as such. Some came to Israel simply to escape, simply because the enemy, the outsider, had labeled them as Jews. They had very little consciousness of that label. They came to Israel simply to find a haven and a refuge. What does it mean to be a Jewish state? How does Israel fulfill that mandate? In trying to answer that question, in trying to meet the thrust and the will of its people, Israel has inevitably had to adjust various conflicting views, and it's not been easy. And some have been caught in the attempt by the state to define, to create the largest ambit of freedom, of personal choice, and yet to maintain cohesiveness and unity. Look at the various points of view that have helped to create Israel. There was Herzl's point of view. To Herzl, Israel needed to be nothing more really than the very, very model of a modern technological state in which there would be freedom and opportunity for all. What would be Jewish about the Jewish state? Largely the fact that it fulfilled his ideas of what the social ethic of the prophets insisted upon. Righteousness, righteousness shalt thou pursue. To Ben-Gurion, Israel was to be a Jewish state, which meant what? That it was to observe the Sabbath, at least as the cycle of its week, that Hebrew was to be spoken, and that it was to be the very, very model of a modern socialist democracy, which was his understanding of the burden of Jewish communal life and Jewish ethical teaching over the ages. To Rabbi Maimon or Rabbi Herzog, to the Orthodox who came to Israel, Israel was to be a Jewish state, which meant that in all of its particulars, it was to encourage the fulfillment of the full range of restrictions and prescriptions of duties and of obligations demanded by the halakha, by God, the mitzvot, God's obligations upon Israel. And each of these positions was held wholeheartedly, honestly, and with conviction. And the state of Israel has somehow had to adjust these conflicting points of view. Now, I have some colleagues. There are leaders in our so-called reform movement who make it a habit to get up in their pulpits or from their platforms and berate the fact that if they were in Israel, and they are not, but if they were in Israel, they could not perform a marriage. Now, very often, late on a Saturday night, as I come back from a wedding service, I wish I could not perform marriages and could be there simply as a guest. But in any case, what they forget to say is that there are Reform congregations in Israel, there are conservative congregations in Israel, there are all kinds of tangential congregations in Israel. They can conduct their worship entirely to suit themselves. They can organize themselves according to their own principles, and no one will preclude under law their doing so. Yes, some compromises must be made, but it's well to understand why these compromises need to be made and to take history, people, humanity, possibility into consideration, as well as some kind of innocent ideology, some kind of passionate ideology about the separation of church and state, which we really very often have not thought through. In Israel, the question of how does Israel become and fulfill its destiny as a Jewish state takes on, in law, two particular forms. It leads to the definition of the word Jew, insofar as the term Jew applies to qualifications of entrance and admission, citizenship, and insofar as the term Jew, the labeling Jew, qualifies a person under, as far as his laws of personal status are concerned, the rules by which he can get a license to be married, the rules by which he can get a certificate of divorce, the rules by which he can prove his ability to qualify as a legitimate heir to an estate. And these issues must be kept separate, and they must be understood in terms of history, and they must be understood in terms of the possible and the practical. The very, very minimum responsibility of a Jewish state, on this all groups agree, all people agree, is that it must have an open door. It must be a society into which any Jew may come when he finds that he can no longer accept life in the country where he lives, where he finds that life is too insecure for him, where he's been pushed out or exiled from the nation of his citizenship, or where he can come if he simply wants to live in the Holy Land, to live in the land which has been the traditional religious home of our people. On that, there's universal agreement. But an immigration officer needs to have a definition of the term Jew. He reads the first law that the state ever established, the law of return, which says that any Jew shall be admitted to Israel. And he knows that anyone may come to Israel, Jew and non-Jew, and apply for citizenship, but that the non-Jew must go through a process of naturalization. It takes several years, much as the naturalization process does in our own country. But that the Jew simply needs to petition the state to enter and to be an Israeli, and it will be granted him. But what is a Jew? How does he know that the person standing in front of him qualifies? Now, why should there be a problem? Shouldn't it be possible for anyone who wants to be a Jew simply to present himself and to say, I'm a Jew and I want to be a citizen? But what would preclude the million Arabs in Gaza, in the West Bank, suddenly to go to the immigration officer and to say, we are Jews, we demand instantaneous citizenship and the right to vote in the next election? What would happen to the very nature of the state? There needs to be some kind of definition. Now, if the definition is that of traditional religious law, a Jew is one whose mother is Jewish and who has not, according to the modern, more modern interpretations, and who has not actively converted to another faith. But even that latest addition is not fully within the law. So he finds before himself a man by the name of Brother Daniel. Brother Daniel is a lay Catholic priest. He was born in Poland. He was born a Jew. He was raised as a Jew. He fought as a Jew with the partisans during the Second World War. He performed many heroic deeds in which he saved the lives of Jews. And then ultimately he had to flee and he had to hide. And he found himself hiding in a Carmelite nunnery. And there the nuns were gentle to him and kind, and they brought him to the light of the Catholic Church, and he converted, and he had come to Israel in order to lead other young Jews to the light. Here he was. By traditional religious law, he was a Jew. He demanded instant citizenship. Was he to be admitted? But the more important cases had to do with not such obvious issues. What of the man, a Jew, who in Europe had married a non-Jew? Were his children to be admitted to the state under the law of return? In practice, the state insisted that it would establish the rules of admission under the law of return, and in fact has done so to this day. And the basic practical rule has been, let anyone who comes, come. If they believe themselves to be Jews, we will admit them and their wives or their husbands and their children with them, and they will be brought into Israel under the law of return. But this simply passed on the problem, because now the question arose, was a man who was a Jew, whose wife was non-Jewish, was this man qualified, did this man's Israeli citizenship qualify him as a Jew and his children to be Jew insofar as these children marrying others who live within the state, others who are Jews? To understand why this should be a problem, we must understand a bit of the law of the state. Israeli law in matters of personal status is almost identical to the law which was in effect under the British Mandate, which in turn was almost identical to the law which was in effect during the long period of Turkish rule. And for various reasons, this law insisted that each religious community had primary jurisdiction in matters of personal status. That is, if a Muslim wanted to marry another Muslim, the Sharia courts, the courts of the mullahs, the courts of the Orthodox Islamic religious leaders had primary jurisdiction in granting the license and seeing that these two people were under Muslim law permitted to marry one another. And the Bet Din had been granted that right within the Jewish community, and the various synods of the Christian communities had been granted that right for Christians within Israel. In 1948, when the state was established, because this was no time for a great constitutional meeting, because the 20% in Israel who were organized as a national religious party, because they demanded that these rules be continued, the state made the decision that in matters of personal status, marriage, divorce, legitimacy, and inheritance, primary jurisdiction should remain with the religious courts of the individual community. This was to say, in effect, that there would be no civil marriage as such as we recognize it in the United States, and that the qualifications for marriage would be those which had protected the integrity and the purity of Jewish life through the long centuries, rather than those that had come more and more to be accepted in Western society, particularly in Western Europe and these United States. And a number of points of conflict immediately arose. This gentleman came from Europe. He was a Jew. He knew that someplace in his family tradition there was the tradition that he was a Kohen, that he came of Aaronite priestly stock. And he fell in love with this lovely woman who was also a Jewess, but who had been for one reason or another divorced. And they presented themselves to be married. She had a legitimate religious divorce. He was a man who was free of any marital encumbrance. And they presented themselves to the rabbinic courts, and the rabbinic courts said, no, you cannot marry. Because according to the Mishnaic law, a Kohen may not marry a divorced woman. 2,000 years ago and more, they had tried to maintain scrupulously the purity of the priestly stock who officiated the temple in Jerusalem, and this rule, being halakha, had been handed down from generation to generation, and now it was being enforced within the state. This is the daughter, the son of a man who had come to Israel, a Jew, married to a non-Jewish, presented herself or himself to the rabbinic courts, and they said, "We want to marry Sarah. We want to marry Mordecai. We live in the same kibbutz. We're in love with each other." And the court would say, "You cannot now marry unless you in fact convert, because your mother was non-Jewish. But I speak Hebrew fluently. I've been raised in the schools of the kibbutz. I've served in the army. But according to the courts, you must go through this act of conversion, which was somehow, would seem to many to be coercive, in order to be qualified to marry." And so it came about that there was something of a marriage mill in Cyprus, the next nearest free port for marriages to Israel. And one way or another, most Israelis were able to adjust their personal needs to the peculiarities and the sensitivities of the rabbinic law. And at the same time, the rabbinic party was satisfied that they were doing something to maintain the purity of Jewish life, to preclude intermarriage, which was a great concern of theirs. And more than this, they felt deep down, and in this I feel that they were correct, they felt deep down that they were preventing a major schism from developing in Jewish life. Two kinds of Jews in Israel, who could not intermarry with one another because they were operating on totally different halachic disciplinary bases. If in matters of personal status the rabbinic law had not been in effect, then the Orthodox community would have imposed the law upon those under its jurisdiction, the 1 in 5, and the 4 in 5 would have continued to operate under what the rabbis would call hefkerut, where there was no principle other than that of secularism as the organizing rule. And whenever there was love between these two camps, there would have been confusion and chaos and 100 roadblocks to marriage. In this way, by and large, everybody came under the same ambit and the same authority. But obviously, there were people who felt the crunch, people who were caught, many who didn't like it on principle, or for personal reasons. But in fact, was there another way? Now we come to the Shalit case, the case that brought all this into the headlines, into the newspapers these last 3 weeks. In 1949, the State of Israel passed a law which required the registration of all citizens, a population registry to be run by the Department of Interior. This was to provide a record, as all states have a record, of certain vital statistics of the citizenry, and more than that, to provide each citizen with an identity card which would tell the military, police, the security, at a glance, a good deal of information which they require. Israel, after all, is a beleaguered state, and its borders have been endangered since its very beginning. And two questions were put down in this population registry. Dato, his religion; Amo, his nationality, his people. According to traditional law, one's religion and one's nationality are identical. One is Jewish in both. But from the very beginning, a number of confusions arose. A great number in Israel have no religious convictions as such, yet they feel themselves Jewish by peoplehood, Jewish by nation. Ben-Gurion himself has a son, Amos, who has married a non-Jewish, and above all else, Ben-Gurion believes his grandchildren to be Jewish. But if they had answered the question on the registry honestly, religion, they would have had to say, no, nationality, Jewish. And in 1958, Ben-Gurion did make a rather feeble attempt for the old man to change the law, but he was unsuccessful. Now came along this young couple, Shalit, He is a psychologist, an officer in the Israeli Navy. They live in Haifa. And she comes from a long line of atheists. Her father, her family's a fascinating one. They're Scotch. Her father was a professor of geography at Edinburgh University, one of the very early Anglo-Zionists. As early as 1918, he had come to Israel, Palestine at the time, in order to find the appropriate site there for the Hebrew University. And he has credited this professor of geography, Ms. Dr. Geddes, with having been the man who convinced Chaim Weizmann that the Hebrew University should be on Mount Scopus, should be at the very center of the nation, as a symbol of all that Israel stood for. There has been sympathy and understanding of Israel and of the Jewish people in this young lady's home from the very beginning. But there's also been an atheist yichus. The religion of this family for generations has been atheism. They're very proud of the fact that in the French branch of the family, the mother's branch, there hasn't been a Christian in 100 years. No. When it came to registry of the young five-year-old in the family 5 years ago, this couple, a very bright, able, personable, and determined young Jewish couple, came to the registrar, and when they said Amo, nationality, they wrote Jewish. And when they said, he said, Dato, what is the young boy's religion? They wrote, none. And the registrar refused to accept that certification. And Lieutenant Shalit applied to the court for a writ of nisi in order to force the registry as he had, in fact, spoken it to the registrar. And then the long, slow rolls of justice began to take place. And there were serious attempts made by the High Court and by others to have the rule that this two-line registration must, in fact, be continued struck down. Why did the government refuse? Because it does make a difference when you say on your card, religion, Christian, nationality, Dutch, or when your card says religion, Christian, nationality, Egyptian, particularly if you're picked up along the border and no one quite knows what you're doing there. So there were security reasons to maintain this bureaucratic two-line entry, and the matter was presented to the court 2.5 weeks ago, as you know, by a 5-4 decision. The court ordered that the children be registered as the parents had demanded in the first place. Amo, Jewish, Dato, blank. Now, once this decision had been rendered, all heaven broke loose. The religious community in Israel was up in arms. Not so much because the practical consequences of this decision, this particular piece of paper has no presumptive effect in law, but because it violates the basic attitude, theology, philosophy, what you will, of Jewish law, which has been the operative law of our people from time immemorial, which has looked upon nationality and religion as one, as in fact they were throughout the long course of Jewish history. When the Jews were a self-governing community, there was absolutely no difference, no separation between one's nation and one's faith. It didn't matter how strong, how hot you were about the faith, you were a Jew. And we can see the lingering results of that in the Soviet Union to this day, where a person born a Jew bears the stamp Hebrew on his passport or on his visa papers throughout his life. The chief rabbinate, which is remarkably inept in terms of its public relations, failed to present its case positively in terms of what its hopes were for the Jewish state. And in a typical display of pique and ill humor, simply responded to the Supreme Court decision by putting down what's called Isur Torah, a prohibition against any who feel themselves obligated to the law to enregister a child as the court had demanded. The saner heads prevailed. When the world is, Israel's world is in the condition it is now, obviously this kind of tension cannot be allowed to get out of hand. And the cabinet, under prodding from the religious community, and because it wants to avoid the direct confrontation now, the cabinet is going to table a law into the Knesset which will say, in effect, and this is a compromise typical of the kinds of compromise that Israel has had to live with for 20 years, which will say, in effect, one, the Shalit children shall be registered as the court requires. We must protect the integrity of the court. Two, in all subsequent registries, the religion and the nationality of a child must follow the requirements of the rabbinic law. But, there's always a kicker, but, the registrar must accept the testimony of the parents unless he has evidence that they are not telling him the facts as they are. He may not inquire back beyond the present generation. We can't rake up old questions and old coals. And he must have the evidence at his disposal. He cannot simply lay the certificate aside while somebody conducts an intensive investigation. In other words, in theory, the Orthodox community won its point. In fact, the rule was set up largely to obviate the ability of the Orthodox community to prevent the registering of children as parents will it. And since this piece of paper does not have standing in law for other matters, the decision will not have long-ranging practical consequences. But the cabinet went one step further. Because the Orthodox community had chosen to raise this whole issue now, the cabinet has tabled, along with this particular bit of legislation, another bit which amends the law of return, so that the Orthodox community cannot use this present statement of its authority in matters of personal status to preclude the entry of Jews into Israel. And this law says, in effect, that those immigration officers who are empowered to enter and register people upon their entry shall enregister as Jews those who have a Jewish mother and who have not formally affiliated themselves with another religious community, the spouse of anyone who calls himself Jewish, and their children, and anyone who has a valid reason claiming that he is Jewish. And this last is a very interesting addition, because it says, in effect, that anyone who has been converted to Judaism by me, by a non-Orthodox rabbi, or by a non-Orthodox community, and who believes himself and has some kind of paper to prove it, shall be accepted in Israel as a Jew. They will not accept, for purposes of the law of return, only the limited conversion, the few conversions which have been performed by the Orthodox community. We are, in effect, not to get another episode such as we had a few months ago, when these black Jews from Chicago presented themselves in Israel. The basis of their conversion was uncertain, but there was no doubt that they felt themselves to be Jews, that they had for some time practiced the Jewish traditions, and that they wanted to emigrate to Israel and to settle in the Jewish homeland as Jews. The fact that this was their will, the fact that they had some kinds of papers to prove that there had been some kind of religious conversion for the group, this was to be sufficient evidence. What has happened? The practicalities of Jewish life have vitiated the ideological conflict. The government has enlarged the practical area of one's religious freedom, at the same time giving to the Orthodox community a sense that the religious law remains a basic and a valid one in many areas. Now, how does all this sum up? What's involved in it? Simply this. We all want Israel to be a Jewish state. We want it to have a distinctive character. None of us has the right to assume that that which we read into the adjective Jewish is the only substance which this adjective can carry. There must be something Hebraic about the state. The calendar must somehow reflect the traditional calendar, and the ethic must somehow reflect the prophetic tradition, and the humanity must reflect the wisdom of the rabbis, the rabbinic, the reform, the secular Jewish understandings of modern time must all somehow be reflected in what the state becomes. And that's not going to happen overnight, and it's not going to happen instantly, and it's going to take time and understanding and Israel's own growing sense of community for this to take place. It will happen. But in the meantime, Israel will benefit from there being many visions splendid, and we in the diaspora ought to be very careful before we pass high-handed and obstinate judgments, that we, knowing in our smugness exactly what the line must be that Israel will take. There is an amazing amount of religious freedom in Israel today, possibly as great as the religious freedom which we enjoy in these United States. Dayenu.